The mountain plateau concealing the Cerberus Redoubt was an organized masterpiece of impenetrability. 2 centuries before, trained labor and the most advanced technology available had worked hand in glove to ensure that no one, Russian, Red Chinese, or ignorant American citizen, might even suspect it existed. For a handful of years, from the end of one millennium to the beginning of another, it had housed the primary subdivision of the totality concepts over Project Whisper, Project Cerberus. The totality concept was the umbrella designation for American military super-secret researches into many different arcane sciences, from hyperdimensional matter transfer to temporal phasing to a new form of genetics. Most of the separate but related projects had their own hidden installations, like over Project Excalibur in a subterranean complex in New Mexico. The tri-level 30-acre Cerberus facility had come through the new cost in fairly good shape. As with most of the other redoubts, it had been built according to specifications for maximum impenetrability, short of a direct hit. Its radiation shielding was still intact, and it was powered by nuclear generators, and probably would continue to be for at least another 500 years. Lakesh had said that when the redoubt was built, the plateau had been protected by a force field powered by atomic generators. Sometime over the previous century, the energy screen had been permanently deactivated, so new defenses had to be created. Although they couldn't be noticed from the road, an elaborate system of heat-sensing warning devices, night vision video cameras, and motion trigger alarms surrounded the mountain peak. It could be safely assumed that no one or nothing could approach the redoubt undetected. Additionally, on all VIL records, the installation was listed as abandoned nearly 200 years ago. The only evidence that it had ever been occupied before Lakesh and his staff of exiles had come to roost was the illustration near the main sector. Emblazoned on one wall was a large, garishly colored image of a froth-mouthed black hound. 3 stylized heads grew out of a single, exaggeratedly muscled neck, their jaws spewing flame and blood between great fangs. Below the image, rendered in an absurdly ornate Gothic script, was one word: Cerberus. The ferocious guardian of the gateway to Hades seemed an appropriate totem and code name for the project devoted to ripping open gates in the quantum field. The vanadium alloy sector folded aside, accordion fashion. As it opened, a red light flashed and a klaxon sounded. A half dozen men and women in white bodysuits flanked the Sandcat as it rumbled over the threshold past the depiction of the Hellhound. They trained spidery SA-80 submachine guns on the vehicle. It slowed to a halt, the engine idling, and Grant popped the hatch. He, Kane, Bridget, and Domi stiffly disembarked. All of them looked haggard and exhausted, particularly Domi. Grant glared at the blaster bores.
"It's us. They turn off that goddamn noise."
Auerbach, a big red-headed man, stared at him with his good eye. He wore a gauze patch over his left one. It had been injured in a scuffle the month before and was still healing.
"If it's you, you know the SEC protocols."
DeFore stepped forward, a small rad counter in hand. A buxom, stocky woman with dark bronze skin and ash blonde hair, intricately braided at the back of her head. She served as the redoubt's resident medic.
"Mid-range yellow. Not immediately dangerous, but decam is mandatory."
"Is the old man here?"
DeFore looked him over with a critical eye. Kane wasn't a pretty sight. Dark-rimmed eyes netted with red, an unshaved face and unwashed body.
"He's here, in the control center. You need to rest and clean up before you see him."
Without a word, Kane spun on his heel and marched down the 20-foot-wide corridor made of softly gleaming vanadium alloy.
"Kane! Decam first!"
Kane ignored her. She gestured to Kata and Farrell, who rushed forward, slinging their subguns over their shoulders by leather straps. They reached out to grasp Kane's arms. Despite the lack of sleep, Kane's training kicked in automatically, instinctively. He wasn't armed or armored, but he didn't need to be. Gripping Farrell by wrist and shoulder strap, he pivoted and bent at the waist at the same time. The Taiyotoshi throw smashed him into Kata, who flanked his left side. The man stumbled but didn't fall. Kane let momentum carry him all the way around, and with a kick combining karate with the in-close and unartistic aspects of pit fighting, disabled Kata. Farrell made a motion as if to lift the SA-80, but subsided when Kane cast furious eyes in his direction. Kane stepped over him and continued his measured, deliberate tread down the corridor. DeFore, watching him go, plucked agitatedly at Grant's arm.
Stop him!
You stop him, Doc. Of course, if you try, you'll be a living example of physician heal thyself.
Men.
Fuming, Bridget started down the corridor. Kane felt a twinge of regret over laying out the two men. Cotta and Farrell had never been anything but cordial to him. Like the rest of the personnel staffing Cerberus, they were exiles. Except for one, and Kane wasn't sure if that particular one qualified as a person. He strode past the electronically locked door to Balaam's cell without looking at it. He had never visited the entity's confinement facility a second time. His initial reaction to the creature had been a xenophobic, consuming urge to kill it. The door to the control center was up, and Kane stalked beneath it, not even glancing at the consoles of dials, switches, buttons, and flickering lights running the length of the walls. Lakesh was seated before a computer station. A dizzying swirl of mathematical formulas and symbols scrolled over the monitor. Mohandas Lakesh Singh was a lean, wrinkled apparition of a man, with fine hair the color of ash. Thick-lensed spectacles masked his watery blue eyes. A hearing aid was attached to the right earpiece. He looked very old. A man from a past age, which he was. As the former overseer of Project Cerberus, he had been allowed the option of surviving the new cost in cryogenic stasis. After a century-long slumber, he was revived to serve the program of unification. Worn-out body parts were replaced with bionic prosthetics and new organs. Though he looked like a mummy, he was chronologically a shade under 250 years in age. All things considered, he looked fairly spry and healthy. Lakesh didn't look up when Kane stood behind him. Only when he felt his chair swivel roughly in a 180-degree turn, snatching him away from the keyboard, did he even acknowledge he was no longer alone in the vaulted, high-ceilinged room. He blinked owlishly, as though roused from a nap.
"Friend Kane, I'm gratified you've returned, apparently safe and more or less sound."
"No fucking thanks to you. You sent us into a trap."
Lakesh's reaction wasn't what Kane expected. Instead of shocked surprise or denial, the old man's thin lips compressed tightly. He inclined his head on his wattled neck in a short, resigned nod.
"I feared as much."
"What?"
The two men turned toward her as she entered the center.
"You knew?"
"I've been telling you as much for months. He's got his own agenda, and we're nothing but his pawns."
Lakesh made a move as if to rise, but Kane put a firm hand on his shoulder and held him in his chair.
"How much did you know?"
Lakesh tried to fling Kane's hand away. His fingers were very cold, as if all human warmth had been leached out of them during his cryonic sleep.
"Take your hand off me. I won't be manhandled, not by...
By the likes of you. Hear that, Baptiste? The old arrogance of the Ville elite, of the baronial hierarchy, of the Archon Directorate."
Bridget's face paled. Her eyes shone startlingly bright, disturbingly hard, like polished emeralds.
"Lakesh, I trusted you."
Lakesh's seamed face collapsed in a pained network of wrinkles and deep furrows.
"I did not betray you."
"Domi's people were already dead, slaughtered, harvested a full day before we arrived. Salvo and the Grudge Task Force were waiting for us. Only sheer luck and timing kept all of us from being chilled."
"I did not betray you. If that was ever my intent, I could have easily arranged it many times over the last few months."
"Perhaps, but maybe we had a purpose to fill back then. Now that we've fulfilled it, you see no reason to keep us around."
Auerbach, DeFore, and another tech named Rauch stalked in, fingers on the triggers of the subguns, faces taut with anxiety and anger.
"Step away from him, Baptiste."
Bridget didn't move. Contemptuously, she turned her back on the three Cerberus personnel.
"What are you doing?"
"Kane violated the SEC protocols. He attacked Cotta and Farrell. Cotta's on his way to the dispensary. We've got Grant and Domi under guard. Baptiste, get away from Kane. I won't tell you again."
With a surprising surge of strength, Lakesh levered himself out of his chair, slapping aside Kane's restraining hand.
"Lower those guns and stand down. I will not have it. Not here. Do you understand me?"
The redoubt personnel hesitated, gazing with surprised, disconcerted eyes at the old man's sudden and unexpected display of outrage.
"Do as I say, or by God, I'll have all of you transported back to your respective villes, trussed up like turkeys for your barons. I'll even attach gift tags."
The blaster boards dropped.
"Release Grant and Domi immediately. If they want to kick the stuffing out of you for your bad manners, let me know. I'll be happy to help them. Get out of here. Take those guns back to the armory and never, ever touch them again without my express permission.
Sir, the protocol...
I devised the protocols, and I can dispense with them as I wish. Go!
The three people backed out of the center. Lakish's eyes burned with wrath, and he turned them onto Kane and Brigid.
Now, let's return to the topic at hand, shall we?
Kane stared at him unblinkingly.
He
found a chair at a console and dropped into it.
What do you find so amusing, friend Kane?
You. Us. This little madhouse of ours. I was prepared to believe you were playing your game against the Barons, using us as your tools. Conspiracy piled atop conspiracy, until the only conspiracy is to make a stoop like me believe in a conspiracy.
Quite the epiphany of yours. And you, dear Brigid, what had you prepared yourself to believe?
If this is a war, like you've told us, then mistakes and errors of judgment are inevitable.
And if it is not a war, but part of the conspiracy?
Then nothing is inevitable. Even the errors are factors of the conspiracy.
A conspiracy dating back thousands of years with an equal number of vectors doesn't look like a conspiracy or a war, does it?
No, it looks like chaos.
And if it is chaos, then it cannot be a conspiracy, for where is the plan in chaos?
Unless the chaos is a planned introduction of random elements, such as a diversion.
You said something about returning to the topic at hand. Did you or did you not know about a trap?
I suspected, which is a different matter entirely. We'll discuss this later, when you've had the chance to eat, clean up, and rest. As much as I resent her intrusion, DeFore is correct in insisting upon decam.
Kane was reluctant to let the old man off the hook so easily, but Lakesh was right. Kane was exhausted, and he could smell the reek of himself from unbroken hours of exertion. It wasn't pleasant. He and Brigid walked out into the corridor.
Thanks for backing me up in there, Brigid.
I didn't back you up. I had my own questions. You just got to ask yours first.
In the far stall of the white-tiled shower room, a mixture of warm disinfectant and decontamination fluid sprayed from the nozzle. Brigid stepped beneath it, massaging it all over her body. She eyed the small rad counter on the wall, staying beneath the stream until the needle leaned over into the yellow-green zone. Automatically, a jet of cold, clear water gushed down and rinsed the fluid from her body. Stepping out of the cubicle, Brigid pulled on a long robe, glad to be rid of the coarsely woven Outlander garb, and went to her private quarters. Her suite of rooms was a bit larger than the apartment she had lived in at the Enclaves in Cobaltville, but it was just as lacking in frills. More so, actually, because she had been forced to leave behind her few personal belongings and scant collection of mementos. She had often wondered if her four-room suite had ever been occupied before, and if so, by whom. No record of official Cerberus personnel was extant, even in the database. From a closet, she withdrew a white bodysuit. The fabric was of better quality and better fit than the bodysuit she'd worn during her years of service in the historical division. As she shucked out of the robe, the slightly ridiculous notion occurred to her that Kane had seen her naked twice. She hadn't been disturbed by it, due to the circumstances, but now the thought made her feel vulnerable. The return journey from Idaho had been unpleasant in the extreme. All four of them had been keyed up and tense. When told of the fates of her people, Domi had scarcely spoken 10 words during the entire 5 days. She and Kane had barely made eye contact and never shared the rear compartment. The past 3 days had been the hardest to endure. Their supply of food and water had run low, and they had been forced to go on short rations. Far worse than that, the memory of the humiliating hostage situation was a fresh wound, and the continual close contact with Kane was like salt sprinkled into it. Stepping into the bodysuit, Brigid angrily zipped it up and adjusted the Velcro tabs on the rubber-soled boot socks. She looked briefly at her reflection in the mirror on the closet door. The swelling around her eye had gone down, but the bruise was still there, like a stamp of her shame. Her mind flashed back. Instead of making her way back to the Sandcat, she had kept a close eye on the sky. When she'd seen the Deathbird descend, she struck off in that direction, positive that was where Kane would head. she had been rendered a helpless captive with embarrassing ease. Salvo hadn't laid a hand on her. In fact, he had prevented his subordinate from doing so. He had only said one thing to her.
I'm glad I don't have to fetch my own bait.
She would have spit on him, but she had been unable to lift her head. 6 months ago, Bridget Baptiste would not have thought it possible that the reward for her long career as a mid-grade senior archivist in Cobaltville's historical division would be a death sentence and exile. A vast amount of pre-dark historical information had survived the new cost, everything from novels and encyclopedias to vid tapes and digitized computer records. Her primary duty was not to safeguard pre-dark history, but to revise, rewrite, and oftentimes completely disguise it. The political causes leading to the new cost were well known. They were major components of Ville dogma, the doctrine, the articles of faith, and they had to be accurately recorded for posterity. Like everyone else born since inception of the program of unification, Bridget had believed the responsibility for the new cost and its subsequent horrors lay with humankind as a whole. For many years, she had never questioned it. Humanity had been judged guilty and the sentence carried out forthwith. As she rose up the ranks in the division, she was allowed greater access to secret pre-dark records, and she came across references to something called the totality concept, to devices called gateways, to projects bearing the code names of Whisper and Kronos, and documents that hinted at phenomena termed probability wave dysfunctions and alternate event horizons. One day, she was covertly contacted by a faceless group calling itself the Preservationists. Over the following few months, she slowly understood that the Preservationists were archivists like herself, scattered throughout the network of Vills. They were devoted to piecing together the unrevised history of not only the pre-dark, but the post-Holocaust world as well. Whoever the Preservationists really were, they had anticipated her initial skepticism and apprehension. To show their good faith, she found an unfamiliar disc in her work area one morning. On the disc was the journal of one Dr. Mildred Winona Wyeth, a woman born December 17, 1964. A medical doctor, a specialist in cryogenics, she had entered a hospital in late 2000 for minor surgery. An idiosyncratic reaction to the anesthetic left her in a coma, with her vital signs sinking fast. To save her life, the pre-dark white coats had her cryonically frozen. She was revived over a century later by the legendary Ryan Cotter, and she joined his band of warrior survivalists. Though the Wyeth Codex contained her recollections of adventures and wanderings, it dealt in the main with observations, speculations, and theories about the environmental conditions of post-New Cost America. Bridget hadn't known how much of the Codex to believe, but the journal began her secret association with the Preservationists. Though she wondered if her supervisor, Lakesh, was the Preservationist intermediary, she never followed up on her suspicions. When Magistrate Kane brought her a puzzle to solve, an encrypted computer disk found in a hell zone, her illicit delving into pre-dark secrets was no longer an innocent diversion. Though she was able to unlock the disk, the data it held contained far more questions than answers. However, one word, a place name, dominated. Dulce, a secret pre-dark military installation in New Mexico. Her curiosity aroused, Bridget didn't devote much time to contemplating the consequences of hacking into historical files that had been classified as above top secret for over two centuries. The results of her illegal research yielded frightening data about the totality concept, the Mattrans redoubts, and the Archon Directorate. It also brought her up on charges of sedition and put her on a collision course with a secret that had damned humanity since the dawn of time. She found herself embroiled in a strange struggle of wills between Kane and Salvo, his former commanding officer and sponsor. The dynamic between Salvo and Kane was more than the active hostility between enemies. At this point, the outcome of the bitter test of resolve between two tough and ruthless men could have destructive consequences to everyone at Cerberus. Bridget had read enough of pre-dark psychological theory to understand the emotional matrix at work. Kane had assumed the role of ideological doppelganger, or alter ego, to Salvo, and both were caught in an interdependent web of vengeance and vindication. She remembered Salvo's words in her cell in the administrative monolith on the eve of her scheduled execution. He was driven by family honor, and it was through Kane he wanted to exact his revenge. Salvo hadn't explained the tarnish on his name or how Kane's father had put it there, Nor did Cain appear to have any idea of what it was all about, but he accepted the enmity almost gratefully. Brigid only knew that she violently resented being used as a pawn in a private, childish war of tit-for-tat. It diluted the real work of Cerberus, and she blamed Cain and his blunt-brained mag's arrogance for playing Salvo's game. On a deeper level, she knew, albeit reluctantly, that if Cain truly was a blunt-brained mag, he would have left her for Salvo, not just back in Idaho, but in Cobaltville as well. She ran a brush through her heavy mounds of tangled hair. She was an orderly, dedicated, brilliant, almost compulsively tidy woman. On the other hand, Cain wasn't exactly stable. He had the tension, speed, and power of a stalking wolf. But unlike a stalking wolf, he had almost no patience at all. One could never tell what Cain would say or do. More than once, he had displayed a reckless disregard for his own life when hers was threatened. Perhaps his unpredictable behavior charted the progress of a man struggling foolishly and bravely toward the light of redemption. And perhaps she was engaged in that same struggle, only by a different path, which ideally led to the same destination. During their nightmarish mission in the Black Gobi, she had risked her own life to save his, acting on purely instinctive, almost primal impulses. She had been tortured, incapacitated, left in a state of shock. Yet when she saw the Tushegun's blade at the helpless Cain's throat, only one emotion motivated her. She would not watch him die. The vision she had experienced during the Mattran's jump to Russia, then again in the subterranean chamber beneath Karakoto, floated through her mind. But it was more than a vision. It was a memory. She was lashed to the stirrup of a saddle, lying in the muddy track of a road. Men in chainmail armor laughed and jeered above her, and long black tongues of whips licked out with hisses and cracks. Calloused hands fondled her breasts, forced themselves between her legs.
Give over, bitch!
No!
Then she saw a man rushing from a hedgerow lining the road. He was thin and hollow-cheeked, perhaps 19 or 20 years old. His gray-blue eyes burned with rage. She knew him. He knocked men aside to reach her, and a spiked mace rose above his head, poised there for a breathless second, then dropped straight down. She knew the young man had been Cain, knew it on a level so visceral and soul-deep that the intellectual prowess she prided herself upon could never touch it. As the former overseer of Project Cerberus, Lakesh presumably was familiar with all the side effects of Mattran's jumping. Brigid had never told him about her vision of a past life. She feared what Lakesh would tell her, not only about herself, but about Cain. Grant was tired. He had driven the last 100 miles back to Cerberus in a state of self-induced hypnosis, his mind asleep, yet completely attuned to what the body was doing. It was a state he referred to as mag-mind, a technique that emptied the consciousness of the non-essentials and allowed the instincts, honed in hundreds of hell zones over the years, to take over. It left him drained. Grant had just finished dressing when he heard the faint rap at his door.
Come.
Instead of the bronze-skinned, dark-eyed medic, Domi slipped in. She shut the door behind her.
You know what you promised.
I know.
Then she buried her face in her hands, her slender shoulders quaking. Grant gazed at her in silent surprise. Domi was fun-loving, playful, carefree. She had made no secret of her desire to bed him. In fact, she was so blatant about it, Grant had secured a promise from her that her attempts at seduction would stop, or he would never speak to her again. He hadn't seen her shed a tear, or ever evince any emotion other than a glib cheeriness that she was away from the Tartarus pits of Cobaltville. Even while visiting him during his recovery after the Mongolia mission, she had made light of his injuries. Unlike himself, Cain, and his companions, the only life path she had abandoned was the marginal existence as an outlander, and later as Guana Teague's sex slave. Certainly, her past had little to make her misty-eyed with nostalgia. Because Domi had been so quiet on the return trip from Cuprum, Grant had assumed she'd come to terms with the loss of her people, accepting it with the resigned equanimity characteristic of outlanders. Now, watching her weep, he felt ashamed of his casual assumption that the girl had no past to mourn, or the emotional structure to grieve. It was certainly not Domi's first introduction to death and suffering, but it was the deepest. Grant stepped over to her and hesitantly enfolded her small frame in his big arms. He clumsily patted her shoulder. Domi pressed her face against him, and he noted absently that the crown of her tousled head barely topped his ribcage. He stroked her head, soothing her, not knowing what to say.
It's all right. It's all right.
Grant had the suspicion she would move her body against his suggestively, but she didn't. Domi simply wept within the embrace of his arms. Bleakly, he considered that such open displays of human emotions, even honest lust, were becoming more rare with every passing day. True feelings were being bred out of the race, at least those living on the bounty of the Barons. Outlanders, sneered at by the elite of the Vils, were possibly the last real human beings on the planet, and they were an endangered species. As a magistrate, he had killed dozens of them in the performance of his duty, but he had murdered more than just Outlander bodies. He had destroyed their spirits as well. Grant felt his throat thicken with guilt. He held Domi tighter, cradling her head. He and Kane had worked as the unaware servants of the Archons, the life-haters, the soul-stealers. Guilt, that was the whole gimmick. For the past 90 years, it was beaten into the descendants of the Nukost survivors that Judgment Day had arrived and humanity was rightly punished. People were encouraged to tolerate, even welcome, a world of unremitting ordeals, conflict, and death because humanity had ruined the world, and therefore the punishment was deserved. Love among humans was the hardest bond to break, so people were conditioned to believe that since humans were intrinsically evil, to love another one was to love evil. That way, all human beings forever remained strangers to one another. Grant found a bitter chuckle working its way up his throat. He did his best to choke it down, but finally it rose past his lips. Domi lifted her head, tears filling her eyes, streaming down her face.
It makes you laugh?
It's not true unless it makes you laugh. But you don't understand unless it makes you cry.
Rinsing the lather from his face, Kane critically eyed the clean-shaved reflection staring sullenly at him from the mirror. It was a face that had once frequently laughed, belonging to someone who liked adventure and pretty girls, and gazed out at the world with prideful eyes. The owner of that face had forgotten all those things. It was drawn and lined with pain, with a look as one staring out between the bars of a cage. He toweled his face dry and padded naked to the closet. He hesitated before pulling out one of the bodysuits. Black was more his color. It had been his color for many years, and jumping abruptly to white disoriented him. The pearl-gray, high-collared bodysuit he had worn as an off-duty mag suited him best. Its color accurately reflected his straddling two opposing emotional and ethical poles. "Somewhere in the middle," he said to himself snidely, "as usual." He glanced down at himself before covering his body with the white garment. Violence had left its history, wheeled white marks against the smooth, pale bronze. He lifted his hands and inspected them. They were lean, long, sinewy fingers designed for killing, not for loving. He tried to imagine them running through the sunset color of Baptiste's hair, but the picture refused to form. It was much easier to visualize his fingers knotting around Salvo's neck, crushing flesh and gristle beneath them. His heart began to pound. His muscles coiled, and a bitter taste was on his tongue. He recognized it as hatred and rage. He filled a glass with water from the faucet and rinsed his mouth out. The taste wouldn't wash. Kane sat on the edge of the bed, chin on his fist, memories skittering back to the day only a few months ago, when he had sat there and contemplated putting the boar of his sin-eater to his head. Of course, he had been suffering a severe case of shock, having just escaped Cobaltville, learned the backstory of the Nukost, and been introduced to a representative of the Archon Directorate. Reinvention of the human identity was something that had never occurred to him before. He had been a magistrate, sanctioned both legally and spiritually to enforce the laws of the Barons and arrest the flood tide of chaos by any means necessary. Though he had often entertained doubts about his life path, his identity seemed inviolate. Now he understood that his identity had derived from his role as a mag, and both were lost to him forever. Maybe that was the reason he couldn't put Salvo behind him, couldn't view him strictly as a tactical problem to be dealt with cleanly and dispassionately. Salvo was his anchor to his old self, his former identity, but the connecting chain was tangled up with Baptiste. He resented her for that, for adding a confusing element to what should be a simple, straightforward blood vendetta. And she, in return, resented him for allowing a personal feud to interfere with the greater war.
Damn it.
Kane felt his lips tug in a mirthless smile. A war that could not be won was no war at all. True, a victory had been scored in Dulsa, but only because Baron Cobalt had been taken completely off guard. Shortly thereafter, he had convened a council of the Nine Barons. The hybrid intermediaries of the Directorate were smug in the knowledge they must win out. The odds were too great, too improbable for such a small force of seditionists to oppose the combined might of the Vils and the Directorate. The Barons and their direct progenitors had, after all, cleaned up the horrors of the Deathlands. In the century following the New Cost, the Barons had warred against one another, each struggling for control and absolute power over territory. Then they realized, or were taught, that rewards were greater if unity was achieved, in common purpose and organized. Territories were redefined, treaties were struck between the Barons, and their individual city-states became interconnected points in a continent-spanning network. The program of unification was ratified and ruthlessly employed. The reconstructed form of government was shared by all the formerly independent baronies, all but nine. Those baronies survived the long wars over territorial expansion and resources, and control of the continent was divided among them. The pretenders, those who were not part of the original hierarchy, but had arrogantly assumed the title, were overrun, exterminated, and their territories were absorbed. Many previously unknown stockpiles were opened up and their contents distributed evenly among the barons. Though the technologies were restricted for the use of those who held the reins, life overall improved for the citizens in and around the Vils. Manufacturing industries, totally under the control of the Vils, began again. But it wasn't all the doing of the barons. Someone or something else was pulling the strings to make humanity dance to a tune of the damned. Kane massaged his eyes with the heels of his hands. He remembered how his father's face had looked in the cryonic canister in Nightmare Alley, composed and calm in a forever sleep. He remembered Baron Cobalt's mocking words when he declared he was a hybrid of human and Archon.
At least my human genes spring from the very best carefully selected stock. Much of that superior genetic material derives from your father.
Kane hadn't killed the Baron, though the incendiary grenades he and Grant had employed at the cryogenics crypt more than likely consumed his father's body. He had spared the vampire and slain the victim. Memories could be both friend and foe. He wondered, not for the first time, if Lakesh's war had little or nothing to do with bullets and grenades. It was a wild battle of the human heart, of the human spirit's rage to live. Such wars never did end. Inside the windowless walls of Cerberus, time was measured by the controlled dimming and brightening of lights to simulate dawn and dusk. At 0300, the lights were very dim. Lakesh met Grant, Bridget, and Kane in the control center. The section of vanadium wall was open to reveal the huge Mercator projection map of the world. Flickers of light shone on almost every continent, connected by glowing threads. The spots of light represented all functioning MatTrans gateway units worldwide. The map also delineated the geophysical alterations caused by the New Cost. They took seats around the master monitor screen, a 4-foot square of ground glass. Lakesh listened without interruption to Kane's terse details about the Idaho foray. He didn't even raise an eyebrow when Grant displayed the compact motion sensor.
I was unaware of the formation of the task force, though I suspected something like it would emerge from the Council of the Nine. Last month, while you were in Russia, I had a private audience with Baron Cobalt.
Though Lakesh was one of the Baron's inner circle, private audiences were rare.
He told you about the grudge?
No, but he indicated that he considered Kane's apprehension a very personal priority.
You didn't think that was worth mentioning?
Keep in mind the condition all three of you were in, friend Kane. You needed time to convalesce without adding more misery to the mix. 90% of the healing process is attitude, you know.
Kane pursed his lips as if he tasted something sour. He reluctantly agreed with Lakesh's opinion. He and Bridget in particular had been grievously wounded, and at the time of their return to Cerberus, not even Defoe knew if the injuries were permanent.
Then you'd better stay out of Cobaltville for a while, Lakesh. You're the obvious suspect of being the leak.
That I cannot do. If I am a suspect, then a prolonged absence will only serve to further compromise me.
You don't seem too worried about being suspected.
Bah. I have other more pressing concerns. My research regarding the origin point of the Archons, for one.
According to pre-Dark classified files, the speculation was they came from the Zeti Reticuli star system.
Perhaps they did, many, many eons ago. Or their forebears did.
Forebears?
Yes. During my years at Dulce, I read the autopsy reports of Archon bodies recovered from various so-called saucer crashes, particularly the one at Roswell. Forensic and genetic findings indicated they were descended from an unknown reptilian species.
So what?
For as long as humanity has kept records, there have been legends of a mysterious serpent folk descending from the heavens to participate in the creation of humankind. Cultures as widespread as those of Sumeria, Babylonia, China, Japan, and even Central America have legend cycles about these reptilian beings.
Serpents or dragons signified divine heritage in many Asian countries.
Exactly. Known in ancient codices and texts as the serpent folk, a Sumerian tablet calls them the Anunnaki. According to a Hebrew document, the Haggadah, the serpent folk were described as standing upright like humans and in height were equal to the camel. The document mentions their superior mental gifts despite their possession of a visage like a viper.
Did these snake faces have individual names?
Two of them did, Grant. The Sumerian records call them Enki and Enlil. The Haggadah refers to the king of the folk as Belial, obviously a derivation of Enlil. Enki and Enlil were given the task of creating a labor force on Earth to mine ore. This they did by a process which sounds suspiciously like gene manipulation of the original species. Since we know the Archons have been engaged in a program of crossbreeding for many centuries, perhaps the serpent folk did the same to whatever original species the Archons sprang from.
Are you saying the Archons were Earth's first humanoid species?
Friend Kane, I am suggesting only that the origins of man are more mysterious than pre-dark science knew. At any rate, the entity called Enlil seems to have been dissatisfied with the way humankind turned out. Rebellious, independent, and possessed of an insatiable curiosity. But we are not discussing ancient history here. In the 20th century, UFO researchers kept stumbling over reports of reptilian creatures working in tandem with the little greys, whom we know as the Archons. Granted, they were reported in a relatively small amount of abduction cases, less than 20%. However, the witnesses in those cases reported that the greys showed the reptiles a marked deference. The last cultural record of the creatures comes from the late 1990s. When the Hale-Bopp comet approached our solar system, some fringe astronomers reported sighting another celestial object following in its wake. The rumor at the time, fueled by paranoia, spread the claim that the object was actually a spaceship manned by reptilian beings who were heading this way to enslave humanity or enlighten it. The rumors reached such persistence that NASA was forced to issue a public statement denying the existence of such an object trailing Comet Hale-Bopp.
If the reptiles were still around in the 1990s, what happened to them?
That is the mystery I've been trying to solve, friend Grant. I've reached a provisional hypothesis, which at least fits the superficial facts.
Which are?
There was considerable speculation that the Archons were pan-dimensional, a theory to explain how their craft sometimes seemed to simply disappear. and also how the Archons themselves were reported to float through solid objects.
If they could do that, why has Balaam been your guest these past 3 years?
Perhaps the Archons can only perform these feats with the aid of their quantum path technology.
Quite likely. Removed from its direct influence, Balaam is as helpless as any human would be in like circumstances.
Their technology was the basis for most of the Totality Concept hardware, at least as far as the gateways and the time-trawling devices are concerned. Is it possible to modify what we have here to locate their home dimension?
Not exactly. However, it is possible to utilize natural vortices that historically possess the same principles as a gateway unit.
Grant, Bridget, and Kane gazed at him silently for a long moment. Lakesh waited for the reaction. It was not long in coming.
Let me get this straight. Naturally occurring gateways?
Indeed. My pet project these past few months.
Turning in his chair, he tapped the console's keyboard. Columns of mathematical formulas and twisting geometric shapes appeared on the big VGA screen. Most of them resembled spirals. Bridget put on her former badge of office, a pair of wire-framed rectangular-lensed spectacles, and squinted at the screen.
Before the Nukecost, there was a small but growing body of scientific theory that postulated ancient peoples built megalithic structures, such as the dolmens of Newgrange and Stonehenge, deliberately above power points, packets of the quantum field. These antediluvian constructions were expressions of a long-forgotten system of physics known as hyperdimensional mathematics. The theory provided a fundamental connection between the four forces of nature, a connection between uphill and downhill energy flows. For example, an uphill flow would lead to an invisible higher dimension, a downhill to lower one, the dimension in which we live. Evidence has been found that there are many such vortex convergences on Earth. Some ancient cultures were aware of these vortices and manipulated the energies to open portals into other realms of existence. Personally, I believe this bit of knowledge of our ancestors was all but obliterated with the burning of the Library of Alexandria in the 4th century BC, an act that may have been due to the Archons.
You're postulating that by employing hyperdimensional physics, the Archons could go back and forth from our world to their own?
Lakesh indicated the numerical sequences and forms on the monitor screen.
Observe, please. The math checks out. By comparing and cross-indexing my calculations with legends in the historical database, the best chance of finding one of these vortex points is in Ireland.
Ireland?
Quite so. Also known as Ogia, Insulara Sacra, Hibernia, Ire, the Emerald Isle, ancient land of magic and mystery.
How do you know it still exists? It could have been swamped by tidal waves during the Nukecost. It was an island, right?
It is an island still. I acquired a satellite photo not more than 5 years old. Ireland remains essentially unchanged, unlike its neighbor and traditional foe, Great Britain.
The fact that Cerberus could uplink with a Vela-class reconnaissance satellite had been a matter worthy of astonishment when they had learned of it. Though all of them were aware that in pre-dark years the upper reaches of the planet's atmosphere had been clogged with orbiting satellites, many, designed for spying and surveillance purposes, Vill doctrines claimed that all satellites were now simply free-floating scrap metal. According to legend, there were settlements of a kind in space, even on the moon itself.
Why Ireland? True, there are many megalithic dolmens there, but quite a few in other European countries as well.
Unlike this island, most of those other countries were devastated during the war. Ireland appears to have remained intact, if not entirely unscathed. There is more of a chance that the ancient sites survived. There is another reason. In Celtic tradition, tales of an other world figured very prominently. Some mysterious law, unique to Ireland, seems to bring together the great spaces that divided the domain of the physical with the spiritual. That other world impinged and overlapped their reality constantly, as well as the entities allegedly living in it.
What kind of entities?
The Tuatha De Danann, for one.
The who?
Tuatha De Danann. In Gaelic, it translates as the folk of the god whose mother is Dana. According to ancient and esoteric tradition, the Danann wafted into Ireland on a magic city of light and founded four great centers of wisdom and learning. The Danann brought with them four gifts, which figured in arcane lore for centuries. There was the Liafel, or Stone of Destiny, on which the High Kings of Ireland stood when they were crowned, and which was supposed to roar when the rightful monarch took his place on it. The second treasure of the Danann was the invincible sword of Luch, the Long Arm. The third was a magic spear, which was popularly supposed to be the spear of Longinus, or the Holy Lance, which pierced Christ's side as he hung on the cross. The fourth gift was the cauldron of the Dagda, a vessel which could feed a host of people without ever being emptied. The folklore of most Celtic countries is cluttered with just this sort of thing, all of which can be explained in scientific terms.
And you're going to tell us about the technology on which these magic items were based?
A pointless exercise. It would be sheer speculation, in which we lack the time to indulge. What is not speculation is that the Tuatha De Danann reigned in Ireland for many centuries. They were overthrown by invaders known as the Children of Miled. This race was represented as coming from Bile, a term usually describing the underworld. But the Danann did not perish. By their superior art, they cast over themselves a veil of invisibility and withdrew into the hills and mountains, where they rule in another world.
And you believe the Tuatha De Danann may be Archons?
Or a race very much like them. Consider what I've just told you. 1. They arrived in Ireland on a city of light. 2. They can pass between worlds at will. 3. They possess resources that seem magical to humans. 4. They are a race apart. Even in the oldest legends, they are not described as ever being human.
What's all that have to do with snake people?
Druidic shamans often invoked the Na Ferilt, the beings who maintained the spiritual heat of the land. Their abode was in the Fortress of the High Powers, in the underworld, where they governed the dragons.
Lakesh, that's quite a stretch.
There is more, friend Kane.
Doesn't that just figure?
The screen cleared, and upon it flashed a jumble of symbols, three small circles topping three triangles. The center triangle was a scalene with a pair of isosceles flanking it.
Does this symbol look familiar?
It's very similar to the insignia of Over Project Excalibur, the division of the Totality Concept's bioengineering researches.
And the linchpin of the Archon Directorate's hybridization program.
Kane eyed the symbols on the screen doubtfully.
The insignia we saw in Dulce had the triangles reversed, the points down.
Yeah, so what's that supposed to be? The emblem of another Directorate-sponsored program?
Hardly, friend Grant, though I suspect the Excalibur symbol wasn't chosen at random, and the reversal of it quite intentional. No, this is the emblem adopted by reformed branches of Celtic Druidism, and a secret society which flourished from the 4th century AD to at least the late 1990s, the Priory of Éowyn.
What's an Éowyn?
In Gaelic it means inspiration. The practitioners, the Éowynidion, solved problems or looked for hidden information. Celtic seers were believed to be connected with a specific cosmic database of wisdom. In Celtic tradition, the mistress of wisdom was the Danann goddess Brigid.
Brigid blinked in surprise, sitting up straighter in her chair.
You seem to play out your namesake's role here as well. And I find that something more than a coincidence. Friend Kane, you may find this edifying as well. The most legendary warrior of Gaelic lore was named Cuculain.
What does that have to do with me?
He embodied the ideals of the Celtic warrior. Courage, honor, a deep respect for women, a nonchalant disregard for death, and unmatched arrogance. He was well known for battling hostile aerial beings.
So?
He went by several names, too. One of them was a diminutive of Cuculain. It was rendered as Cain.
Cain knew Lakesh well enough to recognize the intense glint in his eyes. He was preparing to wax eloquently and endlessly on another metaphysical topic relating to destinies, fate, alternate event horizons, and God only knew what else.
What's the significance of this secret society, the Priory of Éowyn?
The pre-Dark World was full of secret societies with many religious trappings, though the majority were little more than exclusive social clubs for the elite. The Priory of Awen was one of the exceptions. There is little information about it in the databases of government intelligence gathering agencies. I found out this much, though. The Totality Concept research projects were far-flung and involved many nations and just as many secret societies. Evidently, the Priory of Awen was one of them. It was a very small enclave of priests which safeguarded the secrets of pre-Christian Ireland, secrets which flew in the face of accepted religious doctrines. According to an MJ-12 briefing document, the Priory had access to knowledge relating to the root race of the Archons, the Naferilt.
The snake people.
Correct. The Priory was allegedly founded by St. Patrick after he had driven the serpents from mainland Ireland. An apocryphal addition to that legend tells of one serpent which was not cast out with the others. Patrick induced it to live on the island of Great Skellig until Judgment Day. The basis of that old myth can be construed to mean the last of the serpent folk, perhaps even Enlil himself. And for all intents and purposes, Judgment Day arrived on January 20th, 2001.
Cain, Bridget, and Grant gazed at Lakesh contemplatively and quietly.
Lakesh, are you aware of how insane all this sounds?
Of course, but is it any more insane than what you've already learned and experienced?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Then allow me to shed a glimmer of the light of sanity upon you. Follow me, children.
The workroom adjacent to the armory was deserted. Rows of drafting tables with T-squares hanging from their sides lined one wall. Only a few lights were on, and Bridget, straining her vision in the gloom, could make out electronic circuitry on some of the drawing boards and construction designs on the others. Lakesh walked to a long, low trestle table and pointed to an object resting on it. It resembled a very squat, broad-based pyramid made of smooth, dark metal. One side was missing and revealed a confusing mass of circuit boards and microprocessors gleaming within it. The pyramid was barely 1 foot in width, its height not exceeding 10 inches.
Behold the fruits of my labors.
What is it?
A prototype interfacer. In essence, it's a miniaturized version of a MATTRANS unit, utilizing much of the same hardware and operating principles. This input port here is for a keyboard, to enter the proper mathematical measurements to effect activation.
Was it for transporting midgets?
If only it were that easy. As you know, the gateways function by tapping into the quantum stream, invisible pathways that run outside of our physical space and back again at distant points. In my day, we call these openings wormholes.
The principle of the MATTRANS units is the activation of quantum wormholes, but I thought the transit paths were linear.
If wormholes can be compared to tunnels, between the relativistic here and there, it stands to reason there are any number of side tunnels and arteries branching off between the primary entrance and exit points.
In theory.
Bridget cast Cain a quick, irritated glance.
Lakesh, if these side tunnels do exist, then your interfacer can activate them?
As friend Cain commented, in theory. This instrument will interact with a vortex's quantum energy and cause a temporary overlapping of two dimensions that exist on different vibratory continuums. The interfacer transmits wavicles, subatomic particles that possess some of the qualities of waves, such as photons and electrons, which have some of the qualities of particles.
Using an index finger, Lakesh traced an X in the air.
The vortex will become an intersection point, a discontinuous quantum jump beyond relativistic space-time.
Grant massaged his temples.
Am I the only one at sea here?
Friend Grant, as physicist Niels Bohr said many years ago, those who are not shocked when they first come across quantum theory cannot have possibly understood it.
I'll probably regret asking this, but have you located one of these naturally occurring gateways, a vortex point?
Of course. It was the first thing I did when I formulated this plan. The Great Chamber Tumulus of Newgrange, on the northern bank of the Boyne.
Why that one?
First, because it was regarded in Irish myth as a dwelling place of the Tuatha De Danann. Second, it is associated with the ancient Celtic doctrine of transmigration. A gateway to Tir na n-Og, the ancient Irish otherworld. A land, to quote Keating, wherein there is neither age nor decay. Unlike other pagan paradises, Tir na n'og was believed to be attainable within mortal life.
How do you propose we get to Ireland? Don't tell me there's a gateway unit there.
There isn't, so I won't. However, there is one in England, though it was not part of the official program. Apparently, one of the units was shipped there in modular form and assembled. It took me days of searching the database, but I finally found the transit initiator code.
Grant's eyes narrowed. He had never made a secret of his violent antipathy toward jumping.
This gateway is fully functional, right? Not like that fucked up one in Russia?
Kane repressed an involuntary shudder at the memory of that particular jump, of the nausea and the debilitating weakness, and the visions. The Cerberus gateway link had been unable to receive a read on the auto-sequence initiators on the Russian unit. The Matterstream carrier wave modulations couldn't be synchronized, which resulted in a severe bout of jump sickness.
I receive a green signal on the auto-sequencer. The quantum path modulations are in sync. However, once you make the jump, you'll have to find your way across the Irish Sea.
What's the intel on England?
Like most intercontinental locations, it is fragmentary at best. The only solid first-hand source of information was derived from the Wyeth Codex. She and her companions made a jump there some 90 years ago. The Holocaust caused a rift in the land, and the North Sea very nearly divided the entire country. London was completely submerged. Dr. Wyeth reported two factions were locked in a battle for supremacy over what was left of Great Britain. One was an agrarian society loosely based on druidic principles. The other was typical of the pseudo-fascistic baronies that sprang up here. In her journal, Dr. Wyeth wrote that the druidic settlement was attacked and damaged. Since that is where the gateway is located, that is where you will materialize.
Grant glowered at the old man from under ridged brows.
You're not asking for much, are you? Jump to England, somehow get to Ireland, hook your doodad up to a quantum vortex, see what happens, and then come back. Simple.
You can pass on it, as friend Kane has pointed out on more than one occasion.
A dozen, at least.
You're under no obligation to accept these missions. However, as I've also pointed out, confrontational tactics against the Vils are utterly futile. Considering the news about the task force, it appears a concerted effort will be made against us. Finding both an offensive and defensive weapon takes on added urgency. We cannot afford to wait for Salvo or the Directorate to find us. Therefore, our only chance of survival, much less of victory, is to slip in an unguarded back door.
That's a snag, isn't it? What if the back door only looks unguarded, and it slams on us and we can't get out?
That's where the concept of sacrifices for the greater good figures into this.
Before I make further sacrifices for the greater good, I want some proof that this jolt-brained scheme of yours has some foundation.
Lakesh peered at him over the rims of his spectacles.
Friend Kane, how may proof be provided unless you reach your destination?
Let's run it up Balaam's flagpole and see if the little bastard salutes.
A century before the Newcost, enlightened minds found it fashionable to speculate that Earth's nearest alien neighbors would be found right next door, on the planet Mars. 100 years later, it was discovered that alien neighbors were much closer than 19th-century scientific theorists ever dreamed. They were living on Earth, and had been for a very, very long time. So long a time, in fact, they felt they had the prior claim. That fact had been the most difficult for Kane, Grant, and Bridget to swallow, much less digest. Kane, in particular, had demanded hard evidence. The creature called Balaam was terrifyingly undeniable. None of the three was anxious to face the creature a second time. On their prior visit to Balaam's holding facility, the entity's proximity aroused basic, primitive, and disturbing emotions in all their psyches. Lakesh paused at the door, fingers poised uncertainly over the keypad.
This might be unwise. All the Archons are psi-linked by some hyperspatial mind filament, you know.
A passive link. If it was active, Balaam would have been sprung a long time ago.
Even though Balaam has been prisoner here for 3 years, we have yet to learn how to open our minds without being manipulated.
We have to learn how to manipulate him.
Lakesh tapped in the 6-digit code. Banks, the creature's attendant, was asleep in his own quarters. They stepped into the wide, low-ceilinged room cautiously. Most of the furnishings consisted of desks and computer terminals. A control console ran the length of the right-hand wall, glass-encased readouts and liquid crystal displays flickering and flashing. A complicated network of glass tubes, beakers, retorts, Bunsen burners, and microscopes covered 3 black-topped lab tables. Upright panes of glass, beaded with condensation, formed the left wall. A deeply recessed room stretched on the other side of them. It was dully lit by an overhead fluorescent strip, glowing a ruddy red. Lakesh had told them that Balaam's optic nerves were very sensitive to light levels barely more than twilight. As they had 5 months before, they faced the glass wall. Lakesh stepped up to it and rapped imperiously with his knobby knuckles. Grant hammered on it with the side of his fist.
Wake up in there, Hellspawn. If we can't sleep, neither can you.
In a replay of their first visit, shadows shifted in the ruddy murk. Peering through the swirl of seething mist, Kane saw the pair of huge, tilted eyes, flaming out of the red-hued gloom. Deep in them, he could see the scorn and the pride of a race so old that the most ancient civilizations on Earth were merely passing fads beside it. He was prepared for the words that twisted into all of their minds.
We are old. When your race was wild and bloody and young, we were already ancient. Your tribe has passed, and we are invincible. All of the achievements of man are dust. They are forgotten. We stand. We know. We are. We stalked above man ere we raised him from the ape. Long was the earth ours, and now we have reclaimed it. We shall still reign when man is reduced to the ape again. We stand, we know, we are.
The first time those words had insinuated themselves into his consciousness, Kane had been overwhelmed, shocked into a brief paralysis. The words and the message aroused panic, fear, and despair in those who heard them. Balaam used a powerful psychological persuasion.
Humans cannot win. We are undefeatable. Your side is in the wrong. The fight isn't worth it. Bow to the inevitable. Surrender.
This time, Kane managed to shake off the telepathically induced inertia. As the speech began to repeat, he dredged up anger, filled his mind with it, and translated it into harsh words.
Fuck you. You're our prisoner. You're at our mercy. There's not a goddamn thing you can do to stop me if I decide to walk in there and break your neck.
We are old. When your race was wild and bloody and young, we were already ancient.
Yeah, so you're old. But the Na'Ferald are a hell of a lot older than you, aren't they?
Like a voice tape rolling on continuous loop, catching and skipping a beat, Balaam's words faded from their minds for an instant. Kane pounced on that pause like a cat would a mouse.
Hit a nerve, didn't I? Na'Ferald, the snakes. We're not wasting our time with you little gray bastards anymore. We're going after your daddies.
Your tribe has passed, and we are invincible. All of the achievements of man are dust. They are forgotten.
We know where you came from, and we're going there. You're beaten. You can't survive. Surrender.
We stand. We know. We are. We stalked above man ere we raised him from the ape. Long was the earth ours, and now we have reclaimed it.
You think you know us, but you don't know our potential. You can learn from us, but nothing of value can be forced on us. You've subdued us, not destroyed us.
The mist boiled and billowed, and for a split second it faded altogether, as did the voice in their heads. Kane felt a thrill of savage satisfaction when he caught the briefest glimpse of an unnaturally slim figure, small and compact. For a fraction of a microsecond, he saw a long, pale gray head and a high, hairless cranium. The fog was generated by Balaam's mind, a hypnotic screen to conceal his true appearance from the apekin who held him prisoner. For the fog to falter, even for an instant, meant that Balaam was shaken, startled, perhaps even afraid. New words entered their minds, and all of them were struck speechless with surprise.
Humanity must have a purpose, and only a single vision can give it purpose. Only one shared consciousness devoted to this single objective can hope to impose order. Your race was dying of despair. Your race had lost its passion to live and to create. We unified you. We stand. We know. We are.
Kane launched a fierce kick at the pane of glass. It shivered in its expanded metal frame, and the beads of moisture jumped.
You little prick stole our passion to live and create. We want it back. We'll get it back, even if we have to burn down your home to get it.
In a billowing swirl, the mist seemed to recede, absorbed by the thick red shadows. Balaam shifted to the far end of the recessed room and out of their sight.
So much for an open discussion.
Humanity must have a purpose. Probably the closest thing to a statement of Archon Directorate policy we're ever likely to get. My congratulations, friend Kane. For the first time in 3 years, Balaam deviated from his patented We Stand, We Know, We Are address. Your instincts were sound. You found a chink in the armor of his arrogance.
Kane nodded, wiping away the film of clammy perspiration on his forehead. He suddenly felt numb with weariness.
He responded to us, interacted with us. Maybe we can open a dialogue with the Directorate and circumvent the Barons altogether.
That would be about as rewarding as barnyard animals negotiating for their freedom with the farmer.
Kane turned his head toward him, a surge of anger beating the hot blood up in his face. His gray-blue eyes blazed like the high sky at sunset.
No, not barnyard animals anymore. Wolves, tigers, animals with fangs and claws and a taste for blood. We're predators now, and predators don't negotiate.